Welcome to The Treasure Hunt, my personal attempt to share my musical curiosity with you. My name is Bas Wiegers, and I'm a conductor. Today, I want to speak about Charles Ives, who was born 150 years ago, in 1874. He was born in the same year as Arnold Schoenberg and Gustav Holst, but on the other side of the ocean, in Connecticut in the United States. On my desk these weeks is his Three Places in New England, and I'm trying to make sense of it. I first encountered Ives when I was still a violin student, and I played his Unanswered Question and also the Country Band March with the Ricciotti Ensemble. I immediately loved the music and sensed a kind of weird freedom in it. In the Unanswered Question, he puts three sort of connected but not simultaneous layers on top of each other. In the Country Band March, he simulates a few marching bands playing different tunes at the same time. By the way, the Country Band March forms the basis also of the second movement of Three Places in New England, the piece I'm now preparing. Then, shortly after my student years, I played violin in a dance performance about Ives, where my favorite piece was the second string quartet, where the players get into an argument and the second violin, which was me, gets very cross because nobody is following his beat. Ives kept coming back in my musical life. A couple of years ago, I was able to make a dream come true and have some arrangements made of the songs which we performed with Thomas Hampson and Klang from Wien in Vienna. You know what? Let's listen to one of these songs, very short. It's called Walt Whitman, and it's orchestrated by Trevor Grahl, with whom I did a podcast a while back. Klang from Wien is playing, Thomas Hampson is singing, and I'm conducting. So as I said, these weeks I'm diving into Three Places in New England. In this piece, Ives pictures three very different places. In the first movement, this place is a memorial for soldiers who lost their lives. In the second movement is a typical place where celebrations for the 4th of July are being held, with multiple bands playing patriotic and festive tunes. In the last movement is a poetic memory of a walk in nature, and through the fog, Ives heard hymns being sung in a distant church. But to shine a bit of light on who Ives was and how he came to write this weird music, I thought I should bring in a guest who knows much more about Charles Ives than I do. This guest is Thomas Brodhead. We met years ago in Lucerne and later in Amsterdam, where I was very lucky to be the second conductor next to Peter Uitvoerd, when we did the Dutch premiere of the new version of the Fourth Symphony with the Concertgebouw Orchestra. Thomas spent 10 years of his life making this new playable version of the Fourth Symphony, and he also helped James Sinclair, another great Ives scholar, with the last version of the Three Places in New England. So he really knows everything there is to know about Charles Ives. I speak to Tom online, as he was in Nashville and I was in Amsterdam, and I'm sorry I didn't get the audio quality on the highest level. I should finally learn how to do this, but there's so much other stuff I'm learning. Anyway, let's dive into the talk about Ives, his three places in New England, his Fourth Symphony, the reception of his work, and how slowly his music becomes easier to play and to enjoy. You will hear bits and pieces of works by Ives too. I'll put links to the performances in the show notes.
So it's so good to see you.
Likewise.
What was the last time we saw each other? It was in Amsterdam, wasn't it?
It was in Amsterdam back in September of 2012.
Wow.
While you were working with Peter Utbish it was the Amsterdam premiere of the new edition.
Exactly.
But the wonderful performance, two performances of the Ives Fourth, in which Peter had the chorus sing and sit in plain clothes in the audience to have this sort of flash mob Ives aspect of the realization of the piece, where suddenly in the first movement, like the chorus is singing from within the audience.
It was such a great idea. We were in the Concertgebouw and he decided to have the chorus sort of hidden in the congregation, because, you know, what they're singing is a congregational hymn. So he was like, I don't want a chorus on stage. I want them sort of in the audience, and that the audience has the feeling that maybe they might sing along, which unfortunately they didn't. But is there, in that material, is that so known in America that your audience maybe not sings along directly, but they recognize all these things? Because that's obviously a thing when you perform this in Europe, half of it or even more will go unrecognized. They go, oh, this is probably a march tune, or this might be a hymn or something, but they won't actually recognize where it's from. How is that when you perform these things in the US?
I'm guessing less and less, especially as U.S. congregations tend to gravitate away from the traditional hymnody of the past, and instead are having like rock bands playing and services and things like that. But when I first encountered the music, I mean, I was raised Methodist, and I only recognized a small number of the hymns. It comes out of that Congregationalist tradition, which was not part of my background at all. So those who were raised in that might have a more direct connection with that and recognize it. But I don't think that you need to know the tunes to be able to be affected by the music.
No, of
and
course.
I think that's the strength of it. It's that he's using them as materials for building up these structures. So it's not required that you should know that this is a particular tune and this is its text. Although if you do, then there's another level of meaning that's there for you,
yeah,
which is part of the strength of the art, I think.
Back a little bit,
sure.
And can you make a sort of general image of what kind of composer Charles Ives is for you?
Well, the only way I can do it is to try to explain Ives to other people. And in the mix, somehow, they either they get it or they don't. Hmm. And you have to understand his story. And I love telling the story. I'll try to be concise. It's easy to get bogged down in details. He grew up in late 19th century New England. His father was a bandmaster, George Ives, who loved music and sound itself and what could be done with sound. And he exposed young Charles, who he saw had great musical potential, to these wild experiments, like dividing the town band into two halves and having them march in opposite directions around the town square, playing different pieces of music, and standing where the two bands would cross paths, and listening to this, you know, music, these two different pieces approach, and then you know, cross in this chaos, and then recede to the distance. You know, having the family sing a hymn or a parlor song in E flat while accompanying them in C to hear bitonality, and creating this sort of like quarter tone instrument to get the notes and the cracks of the keys of the piano. And all the while, you know, Charles Ives was playing drums in his father's band, but he was also playing keyboard, and he became the youngest professional organist in the state of Connecticut when at age 13 he became a supply organist. Meaning that he would travel around and fill in for organists who had to take the Sunday off for whatever reason. So he rehearsed the choir and then played the hymns and so on. So he grew up steeped in all this hymnody, and then also all the popular music that was being played by these town bands who fill a tremendous service for these communities in the age before radio.
I have to make a little insert here. We're going to listen to something that Ives played himself. There is a whole playlist on YouTube. Ives plays Ives. And this is one of the things he plays. It's March number 6 for piano. Here's to Good Old Yale is the tune.
The other component of it is literary, and this connects to the larger meaning in Ives, which is that he came from a family of great readers, and they especially loved those writers from New England, the Transcendentalists and so on, you know, Emerson, Hawthorne, Alcott, Thoreau, and so on.
Thoreau, Emerson.
Yeah. And they were very proud of the fact that Emerson had stayed with the family at one point. That was in the family lore, that he had actually stayed with them, and they were very proud of this. But you know, the thing about transcendentalism is this idea of the oversoul, but also that you can connect the local to the universal. And Ives writes about this extensively, and he says, you know, if Beethoven and Haydn could use beer hall tunes as themes in their symphonies, which they did, which we don't even recognize anymore because we're completely removed from that culture and that music, you know, why can't I do the same thing with the music that is of the common folk? Why can't I take the song of the washerwoman or of the tinsmith and use them as themes and transcend from the local to the universal? He's trying to, you know, to resolve all these. You see, his father, okay, Let me go back to the father, because you can't understand him unless you understand his relationship with his father. He adored the man. His father died tragically of a stroke just like 6 weeks into his first year at Yale. He matriculated in Yale in 1894 when he was 20. And this crushed him. And replacing his father was the music teacher he had at Yale, who was Horatio Parker, who had been groomed in Europe and was considered to be like, you know, the composer who would probably be the first great, you know, American composer. And he's basically a footnote as Charles Ives's teacher. Now, I've studied with him all 4 years, and he probably learned quite a bit from Parker, which he, you know, dismisses in his own writings. But he did write one piece in the style of Parker, the Special Country, which was, it's basically a carbon copy of a work by Parker called Horonabissima. And he found players and he arranged a premiere of the thing shortly after he got out of Yale. And it got a very polite reception in the press. And he said, well, if this is what it means to be a composer in the United States, we're good at it. I don't have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
And then it would seem that he just, you know, shut music off, but no, it just became a very private activity for him.
That's a very, that's a very important part of what we need to know about Charles Ives, is that he decided to not be dependent on composition for his income.
Right.
He decided to do something else, and then to keep that compositional part, that musical part of his, actually completely free to do the most crazy inventive things that otherwise he would definitely not have done, because he, you know, he should have had to make a living, which is a different thing from being a great experimenter. Is that, was that a decision that he took straight out of jail, out of Yale when he, sorry,
had he been jailed at Yale,
of Yale?
I think his Yale years were wonderful. I think he enjoyed them greatly. Mm. He majored in English with, and he got a gentleman's D plus. But he was the captain of the football team and the baseball team there, as he had been during his grammar school years leading up to Yale. So he was quite the athlete. By saying, okay, I'm not going to try to make money off of music, so I can write the kind of music that I want to write, did free him. And boy, did it, because there are about 10,000 pages of music manuscript that are just covered in notation. And these all are before, you know, they all run from, you know, late 1890s through the mid 20s.
There's a time in many a life when it's good of facing death. What are soldier boys? Do their part that people can live in a world where all will have a say. They're conscious always of their country's aim, which is the word. There come hip hip hooray, there come the day when they go to the war. Brave boys are now in action to right every honest country free to live his own native life. They stand for the right, but when it comes to life, they are there, they are there, they are there. As the Allies beat up all of their hearts, the boy be there, fighty hard, and then the world will shout the battle cry of freedom. Chanting on a new Cape drum, chanting tonight, chanting on a new Cape drum. For this rally round the flag, down the people of the world, shouting the little joy of freedom. When we're through this cursed war, all started by sneaking culture, making slaves of men, condemn him, then let all the people.
Can we slowly move into the three places? Because that is such a, it's such a beautiful and important work, and also a work that he spent so much time working on, and also a work that we have so many versions of. But which brings me to a sort of general a general thing that I find fun in playing Ives or studying Ives is that sometimes he even gives options inside the scores, as if not necessarily as if he's not sure, but as if he's curious which one might pick or something. Like, there is a sort of sense of freedom in it, or am I misinterpreting mm-hmm. this?
No. I think he was constitutionally incapable of looking at any passage that he had written without seeing another way that it could be done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so he would often kind of codify these variations on the material by putting in osias, like, you know, this can be done this way. And sometimes there's an osia within an osia.
Yeah. He gives us options, which is really fun, because it feels a little bit like what Benjamin Britten did in his community pieces. Like, he would give people the option to do something, and if you have an extra harp, you could also do it with two, or if you have, you know, five extra cowbells, then, you know, by all means, add them to the mix. You know, it's like there is a sense of excitement in this freedom, I find. And also a sense, it's not, why is this not, I mean, it's an obvious question to you and me, but it's still one that comes back. Why is it not dilettantism? You know, that he writes these kind of things. Also, sometimes the way he writes things is so impractical. And with any other composer, I would be cross, and I would be like, why the hell are you writing it like this? And with Ives, I'm always super forgiving, and I'm sort of happy that you write it this way, because it's somehow so radical or so honest. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Sure. Well, a couple of things come to mind. Remember, there was a time when there weren't ensembles that were playing regularly that you could, you know, be premiering works by new composers. As a composer, you would have to find a group to perform the work. You would have to. So part of it is him coming from a time when you want to have a performance of a piece, you have to find the players and put it together and make it happen that way. So that's part of it. Then there's that other improvisatory thing that's in his mind of like, well, you know, this could be done more interestingly if you just change this over here. So why not put that in? Because he would. There are recordings of him playing piano, the Emerson material from the Concord Sonata and other things and related works. And he never plays them exactly the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like jazz, right? Where you take a tune and you just do variations on it as you hear it. Also didn't feel, you know, confined by anything. Like, that's the amazing thing, that he looked at an orchestra and said, what can be done with this? And saw beyond the bar lines, right? People, you know, even conductors are saying, how do I make it so the music is flowing so it doesn't feel like there is a, you know, an upbeat and a downbeat and everything is just flowing? He broke through the jail of the staff lines and the bar lines. By having things moving at different rates of speed simultaneously, having different keys running simultaneously, things like that, and having spatially separated ensembles and things like that, just to experiment as his father had, you know, suggested to him, to liberate music and to see what could be done with it that can liberate the, you know, that can engage the mind and liberate the spirit.
Yes. And hence giving scholars like you and conductors like me decades of extra work, making sure that some of his pieces can actually be performed, because some of it is really sort of impossible. I dislike impossible, but very highly impractical. And then you really have to come up with solutions when you have like 16 first violins and you want them relatively together. You have to come up with solutions that are unfortunately more pragmatic than the dreaming that Charles Ives was allowed to do behind his desk, right?
This is true. But what I found is that as performers become used to increasingly more complex music over time, Ives's music becomes easier and easier to play. I mean, in my travels with the Fourth Symphony, I witnessed a fantastic performance by the University of Kentucky Symphony Orchestra, which was an undergrad college orchestra. They weren't graduate students.
It's amazing, huh?
18, you know, they were like 18 through 22. That was the age range. And they did it very well.
It is true that this age where we are now is maybe we're maybe finally ready for Ives, you know, in the sense that we can actually play and understand and sort of respect and get the whole sort of width of what he was doing, and also have all the scholarly knowledge that we can read and then discard of, or read and use. And, you know, it's a very different world from like 50 years ago, or even, you know, when they were premiered, it was a completely different idea,
and
of course.
Just in my travels with the Fourth Symphony, I can tell you that audiences respond enthusiastically. We don't have attrition where people like vanishing after each movement because they just don't want to. That doesn't happen anymore.
No, I think on the contrary, with Ives, there is a sense of, I mean, fun sounds very easy, but there is a sense of excitement and lightness also in his music that always connects directly to the audience.
There's many stories I could tell about audience reactions and what people said to me on performances, but let me just share one. When I when Terry Fisher did the Fourth Symphony with the Utah Symphony in February of 2017, I was there for the rehearsals, and I was there for one of the performances. And I was up in way up in the balcony, as I like to be, because I like being able to see the entire ensemble. There was a young couple sitting behind me in their 20s, man and woman. And after the Ives, which finished the program, was over, I could hear them talking, and the man was seemed to be quite excited. And I turned around, I said, "Oh, did you like that?" And he said, "Look, classical music is new to me. My girlfriend and I got this series, you know, just, you know, a few weeks ago. We've only been to, this is the second classical concert I've ever been to in my life. But the second movement of that Ives symphony is the most incredible thing I've ever heard in my life." And he was just beaming as he was saying that. And I'm like, see, you don't have to know any of the stuff that we're swimming at to be able to respond to it. There's something there that communicates to people.
That was my talk with Thomas Broadhead. Thanks, Tom, for speaking to me. By the way, Tom is also a visual artist and has a great website at thomasbroadhead.com if you want to check what he makes. Now, before I let you go, I want to give you a last recording that I love. It's the Ricciotti Ensemble, the orchestra I mentioned at the beginning. They once played Ives's famous piece, The Unanswered Question, on the Market Square in Haarlem, next to the big St. Bavo Church. It's a recording with lots of surrounding noise, but you can clearly hear the Ives strings humming the harmonies of eternity. You hear the trumpet questioning the human existence, or whatever it is he's questioning. You hear the woodwinds failing to come up with a coherent answer. You also hear some kids playing and calling each other in the background. You hear audience moving, people passing by. And then, after the last trumpet call and the dying away of the strings, and what is supposed to be the silence after the unanswered trumpet question, the universe answers in the form of perfectly timed church bells. These things happen when you play Charles Ives. It opens up the universe. Thanks for listening to The Treasure Hunt, and see you next time.